This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham.
Okay, so no matter what we've seen on CSI, most of us realize that magical findings of DNA are not going to solve challenging mysteries every time. Still, DNA evidence has become an important part of fighting crime, and a new report says it could go even further depending on how public policymakers want to proceed. But there are questions. When should law enforcement be allowed to collect DNA? How long can they keep it? What can they do with it? Those issues may have new urgency as a result of research done by Virginia economist Jennifer Doliak. What she's discovered shows we could likely reduce crime and save taxpayers money depending on how we decide to address some of the trickiest questions. In the hour ahead, we'll talk with Dr. Doliak about her findings, invite your questions, and even check in with a real-life DNA crime fighter. But first, the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Jennifer Doliak does the kind of work that gets people thinking. And some of her latest research may get you thinking about how law enforcement in America should be using DNA. Do we want our police agencies to be as effective as possible? Would it be good if there were fairly easy policy changes that could be made, which would end up reducing crime? What if those changes, in this case expanding the use of DNA databases, could not only cut crime rates but also reduce expense to taxpayers? Well, those are just some of the questions we'll be asking as we examine Dr. Doliak's latest findings, and you are welcome to join in at 888-WMRA-TALK. Now, later in the hour, we're going to be talking with a scientist who for some two decades now has been using DNA evidence to solve crimes. But we begin with the economist whose new study is titled The Effects of DNA Databases on Crime. From the Batten School of Leadership and Public Policy, Jennifer Doliak, welcome to the Insight Studios.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us about this new research. What did you do? Why did you do it? And what did you find?
So I am trying to answer what I think are the big policy questions around DNA databases, how they affect criminal behavior and how they affect crime rates, which is the big outcome I think we all really care about. And there really hadn't been much research on this done before. So I think it's a very interesting topic to delve into. There's a lot of variation in across states in terms of which types of offenders are required to provide DNA samples to their state databases, which are all linked into a national network called CODIS.
Yes. Let's stop here for a moment, mm-hmm. because one of the things that makes it interesting and perhaps is the reason why it's only now that this kind of research can be done, mm-hmm. is there are so many complications when it comes to databases where DNA evidence is stored. All states have their own database.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
There's a federal database that you called CODIS that mm-hmm. we'll get back to in a moment. Mm-hmm. And I understand there are even some local communities.
Cities have started their own local DNA index system databases, yes.
So we'll probably have to refer to it as CODIS throughout the program.
Sure.
But at least once, tell us what that stands for.
So it's the Combined DNA Index System. And it includes the offender profiles that are uploaded from the states, as well as forensic evidence that's, again, uploaded from the states, but that was collected at crime scenes.
So this is a national database
This DNA. Is linking, right. This is the national database that's searchable by all the states.
And is this run by the FBI?
This is run by the FBI.
Okay, so let's go back to these key questions that had not yet been answered mm-hmm. that you were trying to find answers to.
Right.
How effective is DNA in solving crimes?
So I am focused mainly on what happens to the individual offenders after their profiles are uploaded to the database. So I compare individuals who were released from prison just before and after a state expanded its database to include their type of crime. And so these are very similar offenders, but one goes into the database and one does not. And I see that the person who goes into the database is about 25% more likely to be convicted again within 3 years than the other guy, which basically implies that everyone's still out there committing crimes. But when they're in the database, the offenders are more likely to get caught again.
Tell us a little bit just about what DNA is. What's in this database? How does my DNA end up in the database?
Sure. So DNA is the genetic material that is unique to each of us. And there are ways to analyze particular points on your DNA profile to basically produce a string of numbers that identifies you. And so that string of numbers goes into the database. It's kind of, you can think of it as a social security number. It's kind of a very high-tech fingerprint. And whether or not you are required to provide a DNA sample that would be uploaded to your state database depends on state law. So every state has different rules about which types of offenders are required to provide a DNA profile. Most of the states started with kind of the worst offenders, the murderers, the sex offenders, and then gradually added more and more less serious felonies and then misdemeanors. And at this point, many states are considering or have already added people simply arrested for different types of crimes. And so there are lots of different rules based on state legislation about who is required to provide a DNA profile.
So all states at this point have databases of DNA of people who have been convicted of murders and rapes and violent crimes.
That's right.
Many states have expanded to what I guess could be called lesser crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And some states you don't even have to be convicted. DNA can be collected when you're arrested,
which in fact is
now a case before the U.S. Supreme Court.
Right. So the Supreme Court is currently hearing Maryland v. King, and that will decide whether it's constitutional to collect DNA samples from people not yet convicted of an offense.
And Jennifer Doleac, is there also some consideration of the quality of the DNA evidence? You said that this basically amounts to a string of numbers that are taken after examining some sort of DNA sample, whether directly from a person or from a crime scene.
Mm-hmm.
And there are sort of, like you mentioned, fingerprints, number of points.
Right. So the way that DNA is analyzed to create these profiles, they look at 13 specific points on your DNA and basically do a count of the number of repeats at those points. It's kind of junk DNA portions of your DNA. We can let Brad might be a better person to talk about to really get into the science here. But the federal database has pretty strict rules about the quality of the crime labs and what the analysis had to be like in order for the profiles to be uploaded to CODIS, to the federal system. So states can be a little bit more lenient if they just want to keep their DNA profiles to themselves, but obviously most would want to contribute them to the national
database.
And
do I understand correctly that the national database run by the FBI, which is commonly referred to as CODIS,
mm-hmm.
that there have to be 13 established points in the DNA that's been registered?
That's right.
To qualify as being of enough quality to go into the federal database.
Right. So they're looking at 13 points, and that minimizes the probability of a false positive. So if you look at fewer points than that, there could be more people who have the same, say, five points in common, but they would be much less likely to have all 13 in common.
So again, comparing it to fingerprints, it's like the difference between a partial fingerprint and something closer to a full fingerprint.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So what were you finding in terms of answering these questions that started you on this journey?
Right. So again, on the individual offender level, I found that people in the database were much more likely to go back to prison when their DNA was profiled than very similar offenders who were not in the database just by chance. And so this suggests that this is helping us catch people more quickly. There had been a hope, I think, that this would have a big deterrent effect on crime. And there might be on some people, but on average, we're catching people more quickly for the crimes they're still committing. And then when I looked at crime rates, I used the variation in state in the timing of state laws and expansions to include new types of offenders to test the impact of database size on crime rates. And I find that larger databases led to drops in violent crime and particular kinds of volume property crimes where there are a few people committing most of the offenses.
Tell us a little bit about that. Back up for me, mm-hmm. if you could, Jennifer Doleac, and maybe give me an example.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a particular city or a particular location that had a larger database and it was having an effect on crime in that area?
So, for instance, Virginia is a great example of a state that has been kind of on the forefront of this technology. And they have a larger database than most and expanded their database very quickly to include all felons. And so they saw a bigger drop in crime than other states that used their databases in a much more limited fashion.
So what's causing the drop in crime? Is somebody saying to themselves, I was arrested, I was convicted, they took my DNA. Mm-hmm. I know if I commit another crime in Virginia, there's a good chance that my DNA is going to end up at the crime scene, so I shouldn't commit crimes in Virginia?
That is one way in which I think everyone is hoping that these databases might work. Again, on the individual offender level, I don't see that happening a lot. But certainly, perhaps over time, as everyone learns how these databases are working, there could be more of a deterrent effect on crime. So that's kind of the rational actor model of criminal offense, which as an economist, I like to think is operating on some level, that everyone's weighing the costs and benefits of their actions. And when they know there's a very high probability that they'll get caught again if they commit another crime, that they'll be less likely to commit that crime. But at least on the individual level, it seems like what's happening is that we're just picking people up more quickly for the crimes they're committing and taking them off the streets before they can commit more offenses. And so it seems like, I can't say for sure, but it does seem like a big part of the story is that we're catching repeat offenders much more quickly than we were in the past.
The new study is titled simply enough, The Effects of DNA Databases on Crime. There's a link to that report on our Virginia Insight page at WMRA.org. But right now, we are focusing on the study's author, economist and public policy researcher Jennifer Doleac. If you want to speak with her here on Virginia Insight, you can reach us at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Or you can post a question or comment to us on our Facebook page, where we're listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. And that's what Sue chose to do. This on Facebook from Sue. She says, I love the sci-fi TV show Continuum, where a woman police investigator from 50 or 60 years in the future has traveled back in time to our era. But this show seems to be predicting that in only a few decades, police work will be very high-tech, and the ability to track things like everyone's DNA will be commonplace and accepted. Does your guest think that that is the direction we are headed?
Well, I guess that's a choice that we need to make as a society. The technology is improving dramatically. And so this is one reason I'm very interested in DNA database policy and the impact of this tool. It's not just about this tool, but about a lot of other tools that are now at our disposal that dramatically improve the probability that we can catch people who are breaking laws quickly, but that incur some privacy costs. And I think it's very important to measure what the benefit is in terms of increases in public safety in order to have an informed discussion about what trade-offs we're willing to make in terms of privacy.
Tell me what those privacy concerns are.
Well, I think there are a lot of people who are concerned about the government collecting DNA samples from a large subset of the population and then storing those samples, even though at this point, based on current law, DNA databases are only storing this identifying, basically a social security number type of string of numbers. There's no genetic information that's analyzed about, you know, your medical condition or gender or eye color or anything else like that. But you could imagine a scenario where we could get there.
And it sounds like at least one television show is predicting it. Sue, thank you so much for a great question. We're going to continue our conversation about the use of DNA in fighting crime. And in just a few moments, we're going to talk to an actual crime fighter. I don't know if he sees himself that way, but he's actually helped solve a significant number of crimes with his DNA forensic research. So we'll get to all that when we get back in just a bit more than 1 minute. Our in-studio guest on Virginia Insight today is economist and public policy researcher Jennifer Doliak. But joining us now by phone is a man who's been using DNA evidence to fight crime for almost 20 years. We understand that for many of those years, he actually wore a white lab coat and spent time in front of a microscope. But these days, he mostly supervises and directs other people who do those things. From the Virginia Department of Forensic Science, the State Crime Lab's biology program manager, Brad Jenkins. Mr. Jenkins, thank you so very much for making time for us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show, Tom. Appreciate it.
Well, Brad, would you give us a basic primer? What does the State Crime Lab do, and how does DNA evidence enter into what you do?
Right. So we have four labs in the state, and what the lab does is that we basically perform laboratory tests on crime scene evidence that's collected from various crime scenes throughout Virginia. And so law enforcement or crime scene detectives will collect the evidence and bring it to the laboratory for testing. And there's different tests. Might be a fingerprint analysis or a drug analysis or a firearms analysis. In many of the cases, the samples will come to my section for testing, and that's for DNA testing. And Jennifer did a great job explaining a lot of the basics on DNA earlier, but we want evidence that has stains on it. So you might have a homicide where there's blood stains. We want to test those. Sexual assault type cases where you may have seminal fluid stains or tissues, human tissues, and we will basically look for those stains and break open the cells that are in those stains. And cells are kind of the basic building blocks of the human body, and proceed to a DNA typing stage to figure out someone's DNA profile.
And I apologize if I'm having trouble imagining this. Maybe you heard my puzzlement when I was asking Jen to explain some of this when you were on hold there, Brad. But I can imagine fairly easily what a fingerprint looks like and how you go about, even if you're using a computer database, comparing fingerprints in trying to identify somebody. Can you give me a sort of a walkthrough of what you're doing when you're coming up with these DNA identifiers? I guess the 13 points, for example, that Jennifer Doliak was telling us about are in federal databases?
Right. So we actually look at 16 areas of DNA, and some of the states are a little different, and we need to have 13 areas of DNA to be able to search at a national level. So we look at 16 areas of DNA.
And I just have trouble picturing in my mind what that looks like. Are you looking in a microscope and seeing something, or?
No. We have this process in the lab that makes copies of the DNA. It'll make about a million copies in about 4 hours. And then we put that DNA in an instrument, and the DNA is tagged with these fluorescent tags. So it looks like if you go to the hospital and have an EKG done, and you'll see a piece of paper. Hopefully it will not be flatlined. It'll have peaks on that piece of paper. So it looks like a piece of paper with different peaks on it, and those peaks correspond to a person's DNA type. And a person will either have one peak because they have inherited the same DNA from each parent, or they'll have two peaks because they've inherited a different DNA type from each parent. And so it corresponds to a number of numbers, and so basically you get a fancy barcode almost of what your DNA type is.
You're nodding your head,
Jennifer. that was a much better explanation than I could have given.
now these numbers, the numbers describe each of these at least 13 points that have been revealed in the DNA search?
That's correct. And so the more areas of DNA testing you do, the more discriminating it becomes. And so it's similar to describing a car. So if you describe a car and mention one thing about the car, let's say that it's a Ford, and in Virginia you may have a million Fords, but if you name 16 things about that car, it becomes very discriminating. So if you say it's a Ford and it's a Mustang, it's a convertible, it's red, has a leather interior, has A and C in the license plate, et cetera, it may narrow it down. There's only one car of that type in Virginia. So looking at 16 areas of DNA, typically that's a profile that's so rare you would only expect to see it once in the world. The world's population is about 7 billion. So basically, the more areas of DNA that you look at, you get a very discriminating type DNA profile. And with that, you're able to search it in these libraries of DNA types to see if you can find a match.
And these points, these 16 different points from the DNA evidence, do they describe particular parts of a human being? Like, is it you could tell my eye color or my propensity for certain health conditions? Or
right. So, no. So these are in areas of DNA that do not code for things that we're aware of yet as scientists. So it's the field is changing greatly over the past 20 years, but these do not code for visual traits or that you're going to catch, that you're going to have a certain disease or that you're have a certain eye color. So that's particularly why we pick them. We don't want them coding for certain traits that we're aware of.
Do you know what they do code for?
A lot of your DNA in your body will not code for visual traits. So there might be some other proteins and other different cellular things that they can code for, but a lot of the DNA in your body doesn't lead to outer appearances or traits or that sort of thing.
So this DNA evidence that you have wouldn't even necessarily tell you what my blood type was?
It will not.
So I think this is actually a pretty important point. I think there's a common misperception, probably based on TV shows like CSI, that that these DNA profiles provide a lot of information. Basically, you know, they analyze your DNA on those TV shows and your photo pops up and all kinds of other information about you. And that is not what these databases are storing.
From the Batten School of Leadership and Public Policy, economist Jennifer Doliak is here in the Insight Studio. From the Virginia Department of Forensic Science, that department's biology program manager, Brad Jenkins, is with us by phone. If you want to talk to either or both, we've got the phone line open at 888-WMRA-TALK. Hey, Brad Jenkins, I know that you've been working with DNA for, what, about 20 years now?
That's correct.
And lots of crimes have been solved as a result of this work. But I also understand that there are a fair number of regulations and restrictions about what you can talk about that might identify anybody. Can you give us a little bit of a sample of a type of crime or a type of mystery and how you approached using DNA to solve it?
You know, we try to use DNA on every possible case that we can in Virginia, and felony conviction. So it's from a stolen car up through a triple homicide that we'll try to do DNA testing on. So there are, you know, literally tens of thousands of cases that we have applied this testing to. And I think some of the most rewarding cases that people come across are cases where it leads to DNA exonerations, where the DNA, a person has been convicted of a crime, but the DNA testing not only eliminates that person, and that means the DNA is not there, but in many cases it leads to find the true perpetrator of that crime. And so we've, in Virginia and in other states, DNA has been used a lot for that type of testing, and those cases are always very rewarding.
I think something that's interesting about that is that in practice it's often very difficult to win an exoneration for someone until you find the right person. You would think that simply proving that the DNA that is in the evidence does not match that the person who's in prison for the crime would be enough to exonerate them. But in practice, finding a match in the database for the actual culprit is actually much more useful, or just as useful in getting that exoneration.
Right, it can certainly help those cases. And it really depends on what evidence, too, that you're testing after the crime has been occurred, et cetera. So I would agree with that.
So what can you get DNA from? What? I mean, you mentioned blood and seminal fluid, but at least from the TV crime shows, it seems like a person could not walk into a room and a really good crime investigator afterward couldn't find some evidence of their DNA.
Right. It's the tests have gotten so sensitive that, yes, you can find DNA on lots of different items. So obviously human body fluids you could find DNA testing on. We end up doing
DNA. Does
that
include sweat?
Correct. So
wow.
You might have obvious DNA in sweat, saliva. We've had cases where partially eaten food has been left behind by, we think, the perpetrator of a crime. So we'll test pizza or we'll test half-eaten hamburger to figure out what DNA types are on there. So that will work. There's areas of DNA called touch DNA testing. So if a weapon is used to harm an individual, then we might be able to swab the grip of that weapon, say from a firearm or from a knife, and do DNA testing on those items to see if we get a profile. And so it has become a test. 20 years ago, I needed a blood stain about the size of a 50-cent piece to do DNA testing on. And today, I need a blood stain about the tenth of a size of a pencil eraser to do DNA testing on. So it's come a long way in 20 years.
And this is, I think, for better and worse. I'm curious, Brad, actually, if to what degree Virginia is grappling with the problem of backlogs in its crime labs. Because I know at this point, a lot of their, you know, juries expect DNA evidence in all of the cases. And it's just there is this sense that there's always DNA evidence at a crime scene. And so people are just submitting everything to a crime lab. And then there just aren't enough resources to test everything. So I'm curious how Virginia is grappling with that.
Right. So there's been literally an explosion of DNA requests over the years. And luckily, we've invested in some robotics to help us with some of our DNA extractions. And I have about 60 staff members in Virginia doing DNA testing. And our backlogs are probably in the best shape they've been in about 20 years.
Brad, you got to tell us about the robotics. What does that look like?
You know, it's not very sexy. It's not a robot that's extracting DNA, but we'll take the stain and then we put this in a tube, and this tube is placed on this platform. And this platform is basically a robot that will add different chemistries to this tube to break the cells open. And then the samples will be purified so we can get rid of the other cellular debris that we don't need. And at the end, we're left with the DNA extract, and the robot can process about 100 samples in about 3.5 hours.
So you've got 60 people working on this. How many robots?
We have 2 robots in each lab, so that would be 8.
Wow. So to answer Jennifer's question, then you actually don't have much of a backlog.
It's better. It's not perfect yet. We're probably looking at about a 3-month backlog on cases. And years ago, the backlog was much larger than that. So we typically can prioritize cases if we need to, but we're looking at about a 2 to 3 month backlog on forensic cases. The data bank, as far as putting samples into CODIS or putting samples into a data bank, they do not have a backlog, so they're processing samples as soon as they come in the door. And that's about a summary of the backlog for you.
Yeah, and I think that's changed a lot over the last few years, and I think the federal government has provided a lot of funding to help clear those backlogs, because that was a really big problem for a long time.
Yes, that has been a tremendous effort throughout the country of reducing the backlogs, both in casework as well as in the data bank, and getting samples processed and into that library of DNA types, if you will, so they can be searched.
Brad Jenkins from the Virginia Department of Forensic Science. Is there any part of me I could leave behind in a room that you could not get a good DNA sample from? I mean, a fingernail, a piece of hair instead of a full hair with follicle?
Your only hope is that you have an identical twin brother.
So you can get DNA from anything.
Just about.
So I had someone in a seminar I gave once suggest that the only good way to evade the detection by this technology would be to go to a barbershop on your way to committing a crime and then flood the crime scene with hair samples from lots of different people, because there's no way you'd be able to avoid leaving your own DNA, which I thought was a pretty creative solution.
Yeah. I wonder if we're going to get in trouble for mentioning that.
I think it is interesting that a lot of people think of murders and sex offenses being the only crimes where you can catch the person using DNA databases. And I've had police officers tell me they love burglaries because burglars bleed a lot. And so burglaries actually are very, it's very useful to collect DNA.
Because they break a window and cut themselves?
They stick their arm through the window and stuff like that.
Brad Jenkins, it's sounding to me like you just have to be fairly reticent about talking about a specific crime and what DNA evidence you collected and how you solved the crime. And I know that there are rules and regulations that even after a crime has been resolved and there's been a conviction, you're still restricted on what you can say. So let me ask you a question this way, if I can get away with it, Brad.
Sure.
If I imagine somebody, maybe a young man, breaks into a fairly nice Mercedes, is driving along, decides he's hungry, goes through the drive-thru at McDonald's and gets himself a burger and some fries. And then all of a sudden it occurs to him that this is a really nice car. It probably has GPS on it, and somebody is going to be able to track it. So he parks the car, jumps out, runs away, but he leaves part of the burger behind. If he's in the DNA database, you're going to be able to find him?
That's correct.
And you've solved crimes just like that?
You know, it's in the interesting thing is it's not just a Virginia database. It can be any database throughout the country, and the DNA will be able to track him down in other states' databases as well.
So something else that might be interesting to talk about is familial DNA testing. I think Virginia does familial searches, basically using the database that they have and looking for, you could think of it as partial matches that might lead you to the family member of someone who's in the database, who's been a convicted offender in the past. And that's certainly on the forefront of how we're using these databases and is one of the more controversial types of procedures. I'm curious how Virginia has used that so far.
Right. So with that is correct. We do familial type DNA searches. And when I was speaking earlier, one of the principles of DNA testing is you get half your DNA from your mom and half your DNA from your father. And so if I tested that fast food from that left behind in that car and I obtained a DNA profile, it gives us an idea of what the parent's DNA profile was or should be. And so we can search the DNA profile from the leftover from the food and see if we have any partial matches, a family member, a mother or father, a close family member in a database, and provide that information as a possible investigative lead to police officers.
I have so many more questions for both of you, but I want to remind our audience that they're invited to join in. 888-WMRA-TALK is our phone number. Our continuing look at the use of DNA in crime solving and how that policy might be improved continues. One-time researcher at the Brookings Institute, former staffer for the Congressional Budget Office, economist Jennifer Doliak, now a faculty member at the University of Virginia's Batten School of Leadership and Public Policy, is one of our guests. She's here because of the new study that she just recently published that's titled The Effects of DNA Databases on Crime. And as long as we were talking about her research on that, we figured we might as well ask Brad Jenkins, who is the biology program manager for the Virginia Department of Forensic Science, to join us. He has long used DNA in crime solving. And Brad kindly agreed. Brad, just before we hit the break, and my tongue got all tied up, it was probably because I was thinking of some of my family members and and how that might lead to identifying me. We were discussing familial DNA, which I guess gets me to wonder what regulations Virginia has that you're aware of what types of DNA can be collected, under what circumstances they can be collected, and how they can be used. Do we have regulations in this state about that?
Oh, absolutely. So it's there are state and federal regulations of what samples can be collected, what samples can be placed in the databases, et cetera.
Can you tell me, are you aware, Jennifer, what some of those regulations in Virginia are?
Well, I mean, for instance, we can collect samples from convicted offenders. We have certain classes of arrestees that we can collect samples and put those samples into databases. We can also put samples in from casework indices, but I'm not allowed to go out on the street and grab a sample from you, Tom, and put it in our database unless you've committed, one of those crimes or in one of those categories.
I don't understand the term casework, Brad.
So there's two avenues for DNA testing. One is DNA databasing, where you take samples from convicted offenders and put them into a database. And the other type of DNA testing is actual casework DNA testing. So if a crime has been committed, we call that casework DNA testing, where an investigator will go to the crime scene and submit evidence for testing.
So that's the casework DNA that you're talking about is DNA that's not identified with any specific human being. It was just pulled from a crime scene as part of the evidence?
You're close. So we have both types of cases in our database, and I can explain that. So we have unsolved cases in there trying to determine who committed that case, but we also put solved cases in there because there's a possibility that an unsolved case will hit to a solved case, and we could link cases together. We may be able to link 20 or 30 DNA cases or crimes together that was all committed by the same perpetrator.
Okay, so let me see if I've got this clear. Let's say Abraham Smith was convicted of a burglary, and he had broken the window and left some blood behind, but you did not actually need the DNA to convict him. Maybe he just, when he was questioned by police, he confessed. But you've now got that DNA from the crime scene in your database, and you know that Abraham committed the crime, so you've linked his name to that DNA?
That's correct. So it's actually linked in our case file, so we may have that information in the case file, or the police jurisdiction would have that information. And so typically, if we had another case that hit to that first case, the Abraham case, we would put the investigators from the second case in contact with the investigators from the first case, and then they would be able to tell those investigators, what has happened to their first case, and so it may solve the second case that way.
So one thing I think that I find fascinating about studying this topic is that even though the marginal cost of adding each additional offender to a database is very low, presumably there are some types of offenders that are more cost effective to add than others. And we really don't have a good sense yet of who those offenders are that we should be focusing on. So I think the presumption was that the really violent criminals would be the most cost effective to add first. And that's why we did that. And then on to people who are convicted and now on to arrestees. But in thinking about, which types of offenders are required to provide DNA profiles in the various states, I think that there's a lot more work that needs to be done to help inform those policy decisions, especially if people are worried about privacy issues. But in thinking about how these types of profiles all interact and helping to connect dots between crime scenes and all the rest, it's I think, very interesting to think about who the most important people are to have in those databases.
And if you're collecting fairly easily these days, DNA from car thefts and burglaries, I guess it could be cost effective if you're getting a lot of those culprits off the street?
Right. And so there are two questions here. One is, I think part of the motivation for adding the more minor offenders early on is that we thought at least a subset of them would eventually commit more violent crimes. So we want to put someone in the database after he's committed a burglary because we think one day he might commit a rape. And so we want to be able to catch him at that point. But it's also, as we've been discussing, possible to use crime scene evidence from burglaries. And so we can actually put people in the database for more minor offenses and catch them for other minor offenses.
Right. That's been very effective for our database. In 20 years in Virginia, we've had a little over 8,000 DNA data bank matches. And 40% of those, or close to 40% of those individuals who were in the database, so they were in there for a property crime offense. So of those 8,500 hits, about 40% of those came from individuals who were in the database for property crimes.
From the Virginia State Crime Lab, Brad Jenkins is with us by phone. From the Batten School of Leadership and Public Policy, economist Jennifer Doliak is here in studio. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. We're going next to Harrisonburg. Robert, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment for our guests, please.
I just wanted to make a comment. Working as a paralegal for a blind attorney here in Harrisonburg, we mostly do criminal defense work. I thought that we were dancing around an issue of which convicted offenders would be ordered for DNA testing. And generally, those are people convicted of felonies. And to the best of my knowledge and belief, working in the court system, that requires a court order upon the conviction for that felony or felonies by the judge. And basically, what they do is they process the person back to the jail, and they do a DNA swab inside the cheek, and they grab some cells, some epithelial cells from inside the cheek, after the court system. And then, of course, the offender must pay for that DNA testing. I just thought I'd add that as a...
Robert, thank you for that clarification. I do want to check with Brad Jenkins from the State Crime Lab to see if he knows. Is that... Do you know, Brad, your understanding, or is it your understanding that anybody who is convicted of a crime has to give a DNA swab that is then entered into the database?
No. It is limited at this point to felony convictions.
Okay. And does it happen automatically once you are convicted, or, as I think Robert is saying, does it happen only after you are convicted plus a judge authorizes it?
You know, that's a good question, and you're out of my area there a little bit. That might be a lawyer type question.
I believe it's automatic after conviction. Different states might have different procedures, but and there might be certain paperwork in between. But in general, if the state law is that anyone convicted of a felony must provide a DNA sample, then that's what's going to happen.
And as we mentioned earlier in the hour, there is a case now before the U.S. Supreme Court where a man was convicted on a cold case crime because when he was arrested in Maryland, not convicted, but arrested for a different crime as an arrestee for that particular level of crime in Maryland, their policy was they could collect DNA from him, mm-hmm. and his attorneys are trying to have that conviction overturned, saying that just being arrested should not mean that you have your DNA collected and used against you. So the U.S. Supreme Court is expected to settle that issue later this year. But Brad Jenkins from the State Crime Lab, did I hear you say that in Virginia, we also have a policy where some arrestees for violent crimes, that DNA is automatically taken for them before they're convicted?
That's correct. So we have about 10 classes of violent arrestees where samples are collected upon arrest and placed in a database.
Brad, do you have a sense of how many hits you're getting from those arrestee profiles that you would from the arrestees who weren't subsequently convicted?
It's a relatively small amount of matches. We have gotten a number of matches to them, mm-hmm. but of the 8,000 matches, I think we have probably 800 matches to arrestees or somewhere in that range.
Robert, thank you so very much for your call. We've got another person in Harrisonburg joining us. This is Ray. Ray, your question or comment, please.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good.
My question was in reference to military service members who have their DNA taken for identification purposes, such as the battlefield identification of body parts and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard conflicting information on whether or not that DNA is included for comparison purposes in law enforcement application.
Brad Jenkins, do you know?
Right. So that is not included in the databases for searching.
It has to meet a certain number of qualifications associated with criminal activity before it gets entered into one of these databases.
Right. You have to be a convicted offender or an arrestee in the state. Right.
That's correct.
Ray, thank you so very much for your call. We answered your question, Ray. Maybe we lost Ray, but
so
still grateful.
One other point that came up in the earlier question is that many state laws require the offenders to pay for the DNA sample. I think is typically seen as one way to fund the DNA analysis. And in general, or for the most part, offenders don't have the money to pay those fees. So in general, so they're typically waived. But that is part of many state laws, which is kind of an interesting tidbit.
Biologist and forensic scientist Brad Jenkins, you told us earlier that you've seen tremendous improvement in the technology associated with DNA evidence over the 20 years that you've been doing this. Do you have any sense of where this is going? What kind of technological improvements could be 10 or 20 years down the line?
Yeah, it'll be something to see. We're in the nearer time frame. We're looking at it testing more areas of DNA, going up to around 24 areas of DNA, and this will give us more discrimination, but it'll also let us, for the first time, to do world DNA databank searches is the idea behind that. So we can, if we don't find matches in the United States, we may be able to search those profiles in other European or Asian databases. So that'll be the first jump in the next 4 or 5 years. So we'll see where that takes us.
And Jennifer, I understand one of the more controversial, at least with some law enforcement types, findings in your research is that the DNA databases, especially when they are expanded and used well, are so cost effective that you don't end up needing as many cops?
Well, so there's been a lot of research done on the cost effectiveness of hiring additional police officers. So this isn't looking at the effectiveness of the average of, you know, the average cop that's already on the streets. But if we wanted to think about hiring additional police officers, it costs a certain amount of money and would reduce crime a certain amount. And so I can use the results from my study to think about what the cost effectiveness is of adding an additional offender to the database and compare that to the cost of doing so. And the returns to scale of DNA databases are so large. Basically, you know, it costs a certain amount of money to set up these crime labs and the computer networks, but adding one more offender is so cheap. And we do see a reduction in crime that's proportionally pretty large, that it is much more cost effective to add offenders to the database than to use the same dollar stuff to hire additional police officers.
Are there ways that you see these databases being expanded? Are there ways that they could be used even more effectively, you think, than they are now?
I think a lot of states are pushing right now to add arrestees to the database, and that's kind of the frontier of database policy. As I mentioned earlier, I think it seems to me that the constraint is more on the crime scene evidence side of having the resources to collect evidence from more crime scenes and run those through the labs, because we can put more and more offenders in the database, but we need the crime scene evidence to match to it. And it does seem like, you know, the marginal effect in economics terms of adding an additional offender should fall depending on the person's propensity to commit crime. So, you know, if we add you to the database, it might not be all that cost effective. But if we add, someone who's been convicted of murder four times, it probably would be more, we'd get more bang for our buck there. So there'll be diminishing marginal returns to adding offenders or adding people to the database on the offender side. But we do have existing backlogs of crime scene evidence. That's probably a good place to put our resources.
Brad Jenkins, I've been resisting, but we've got a few moments left before we're out of time. So I got to ask you, what TV crime show do you watch that you think is most realistic when it compares to the kind of work that actually goes on in forensic science?
Oh, my wife loves those shows and watches them, but I'm not a big fan of them. And I'm sure they're perfectly fine shows, but I'm around that work all day long and don't particularly like watching it when I get home.
What kind of TV do you like watching?
Hey, it's baseball season now, so I've been watching baseball.
Our guests have been Jennifer Doliak, faculty member in both the Department of Economics and the Batten School of Public Policy at the University of Virginia, as well as the biology program manager from the Virginia Department of Forensic Science, Brad Jenkins. The new study that we've been talking about is The Effects of DNA Databases on Crime, published by Dr. Doliak. Thank you both so much for your time.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.